Well, first and foremost, thank you for having me here today, and thanks to Mary Beth for inviting me. And I have a real affinity for Locust Grove. I think it's a wonderful historic site, first and foremost, but I have a couple of personal relationships here. I had one fifth great-grandfather on my dad's side who was an officer under George Rogers Clark, fought in Illinois. I met another descendant here, so we share an ancestor, which is fun. And then my second one is, on my mom's side, another... Sorry. I'm not going to move. But another fifth great grandfather of mine was Dr. Richard Ferguson, who had the dubious distinction of amputating George Rogers Clark's leg. So after this event, we'll be staging a reenactment. So if there's a volunteer, I'll be happy to embark on any surgery. When I begin, though, I want to sort of pose a question to you guys as we get started and think about history and the importance of history in Kentucky. So the question I'd like to pose to you all is, what makes Kentucky, Kentucky? Who are the people? What are the events? What are the traditions? What are the things that really make the bluegrass state what it is? Just shout them out. Kentucky Derby. So we got the Derby. That's great. What else? Derby. We got bourbon. Limestone. Geography. We got Boone. We got Abe Lincoln. We got water. Yeah, that's a good one, actually, because, you know, we have more navigable streams. Yeah, Falls of the Ohio. Whoop. Yeah, you got Mammoth Cave. Ah, old Transy. We got horses. You guys are good. We got the Slugger. What was that in the back? Oh, steamboat history. Love steamboat history. Yep, Lewis and Clark. Yep, have to say old. It took a while, but we got there. That's all that matters. Anything else? Oh, mercy. Prison. It's important, though. Shows how, you know, westward movement. Anything else? Yeah, we got the Civil War history. Yeah, because not only was Lincoln born here, but who else? Jeff Davis. You know, born less than 100 miles and less than 1 year apart. So gives us geology. An interest. Yeah, geology. No relation to me, but we've got Colonel Sanders. I wish. I'd love to be the heir to the chicken fortune, but... What's that? Well, yeah. Glaciation. Yeah, we have UPS here now. Do a couple more. Mammoth Cave. What's that? First Catholic Diocese. See, these are all great answers. And what we did was, last year during Kentucky's 225th anniversary, we went around the state and we posed this question. We said, what makes Kentucky, Kentucky? And then we looked at it in sort of a more negative light. We said, well, what makes Kentucky, Kentucky that we're normally not so proud of? So everything from the opioid epidemic, residents' health, poverty, people came up with a great number of things. And as we did, what's that? Yep, lynchings was another bad thing that we talked about. And as we did this, it quickly became apparent that one thing when we heard about Boone, when we heard about Lincoln, when we heard about George Rogers Clark, we heard about Mammoth Cave and all these wonderful traditions is just how connected Kentuckians are to our history and how much this history and heritage is important to us. We also posed the question, when we talked about the problems in the state, like the opioid epidemic, we said, well, how can our history sort of help us create solutions for those challenges. And we came up with some really, really good things. But what was eye-opening for us at the Kentucky Historical Society was not only how much were modern-day Kentuckians connected to that history, but they really understood how the past is also really important to our present and also to our future. Now I want to pose another quick question for you. What are ways that history has been in the news lately? What are some things that really makes you think about our past that you see in the news? The statues, yeah. You know, the first big one, you know, the Castleman statue here, the Prentice statue, in Lexington, the Confederate statues that were moved into the cemetery. What are some other ways that you've seen history in the news? Yeah, Mitch McConnell. He spoke at the old state capitol in Kentucky. He's doing a book on leaders in the Senate in the past. And so one thing that was eye-opening about that lecture is how McConnell and his modern colleagues are hopefully thinking about the past. And that was sort of another eye-opening experience we had. Coal mining is a great one, too. You know, it's the decline of coal. People talk about that, something very important to Kentucky's economy and how that's evolved and how that's changed. That's in the news a lot. Yep, the racial divide, goes back to the antebellum period, something we still contend with today. The funeral of McCain also brought up conversations about the Vietnam War, his experiences as a POW. So the point I'm trying to make here is sort of twofold. So first, not only are Kentuckians very well connected to our past, but our past is continually put in front of our faces, whether it's from political decisions that are made, whether it's the statues that are in the news, whether it's tariffs. You know, Henry Clay, for example, was a big advocate of tariffs, which are in the news as well. So there's always a Kentucky connection to almost any issue you can think of, which is pretty darn amazing. And so as you leave here today, I want you to sort of try to think about ways that our past is reflected in these stories and in this on these issues. Well, Daniel Boone, again, who's on the board, the great Kentucky pioneer that many people think of when we do this exercise, he once said, "Curiosity is natural to the soul of man, and interesting objects have a powerful influence on our affections." And I'll read that one more time. "Curiosity is natural to the soul of man, and interesting objects have a powerful influence on our affection." Well, so how do we know that objects have a powerful influence on us today? Well, it's museums. It's wonderful places like here at Locust Grove. It's other places across Louisville. You've got the Kentucky Derby Museum. You've got Farmington. You've got the Speed. What else? You've got Riverside. Yep. And Riverside, the Farnsley-Moorman Landing. Yeah, the Fraser. And so there are all these wonderful places that use objects to talk about not only our past, but why history is important and how history can help us craft solutions to modern problems. I would also throw in there Cave Hill Cemetery. You know, that's one of Louisville's most important historic sites. And I was actually there a couple of weeks ago for a project, and they're doing a great job in terms of the number of tours they're doing, the number of educational events, and way they're bringing in school kids to adults to really learn more about the people who are buried there. Like Dr. Ferguson, like George Rogers Clark, who played an important role with Kentucky's history. Kentucky now has more than 350 museums across the Commonwealth, which is awesome. There are historical societies, and all these places really are there to spark our interest, drive our curiosity, spur innovation. That's an important thing that a lot of sites are doing, and really to provide that proper context that we need in order to solve problems that we face today. But there also are more concrete, important reasons that museums are here, and it's because they are an important driver of our state, local, and national economies. The American Alliance for Museums, which is a national organization for museums and historical societies, recently published an economic impact study that showed the economic benefits of museums. So in addition to having an educational merit, as school field trips come here, the kids are learning a lot, but AAM reported that, quote, "The museum sector is also essential to the national economy, generating GDP, stimulating jobs, and contributing taxes." So according to their report, in 2016, museums contributed $50 billion to the national GDP. They supported 625,000 jobs, and that includes over 372,000 direct employees. They also contributed more than $1.2 billion in tax revenue to our national and local economies. Now, this comes on the heels of more than 850 million annual visits to museums across the nation. And when you think about that number, this number represents more than all of the people who attended Major League Baseball games and amusement parks last year. So think about that. More people attended museums than attended pro basketball games, pro football games, NASCAR races, went to Disney, went to Kentucky Kingdom, all those places. So, you know, that really shows you how important these places are to our national economy. So when you hear politicians starting to call for more arenas, for another football stadium, for a new soccer stadium, whatever that may be, which are great economic drivers for our economies, I would also encourage you guys to say, hey, that's great, but just as many people, if not more, are visiting Louisville's museums, so why don't you support them too? And it's a way to make places like Locust Grove continue to thrive. In Kentucky, we know that these places generate tax revenue. Across the state, we know that Kentucky museums employ close to 9,000 people across the state. On average, that's about 74 jobs per county. When you're considering that a lot of our counties are extremely rural, that's actually a very solid number when you think about it across the state. We also know that museums have provided more than $111 million in state and local taxes, too. So again, at times of sharp budget cuts across the state, this shows how economically important museums are here. Why are they important? It's because of heritage tourism. It's because of the visitors who come here from out of state. It turns out tourism in Kentucky, it's the state's third largest industry. You may think it's horses, you may think it's bourbon. It's not. It's actually tourism and the revenue that's generated. So it translates to more than $1.5 billion in tax revenue, tourism does to Kentucky. And that's why I'm so appreciative that you guys are here. Well, museums are doing more than just driving people, bringing them in, and helping raise tax revenue. They're also telling important stories tied to our past. History organizations understand that our past is relevant to our future. And I'm gonna give you a couple of quick examples of how some sites are looking at modern issues and are really trying to use history as a way to craft issues of importance that resound to us today. Now, if you've been here to Locust Grove over the last couple of years, if you've paid attention to their educational programming, you've heard a lot of discussion about hemp. You know it's been in the news a lot lately as the Kentucky Department of Agriculture and the federal government both are really sort of wrestling over whether or not hemp should be legalized as a cash crop in Kentucky. So our past can indicate if this crop will be successful in this state, and by examining our past, we can really determine what was the impact of hemp as a cash crop in Kentucky previously. Well, hemp cultivation began in Kentucky as early as 1775. It was down in Boyle County near Danville along Clark's Run. There was an early pioneer who planted hemp, and it became the first time the plant was planted in Kentucky, and it quickly thrived in bluegrass soil. Throughout the 19th century, hemp fibers were woven into bags, rope, and things to essentially support the southern cotton market down in the deep south. It continued to thrive into the early 20th century. By 1902, there was one government botanist who wrote, quote, "The production of hemp is almost confined to Kentucky. 3/4 of the American hemp fiber is produced in the counties of Fayette, Woodford, Jessamine, Garrett, Clark, Bourbon, Boyle, Scott, and Shelby." So again, 3/4 of American hemp, and most of the hemp that was part of the worldwide economy at that point was American hemp. We know that 3/4 of essentially the world supply of that plant was grown in 9 counties across Kentucky. And that's at the beginning of the 20th century. So in addition to highlighting the economic benefits of hemp, Kentucky sites like Locust Grove, like Ashland, the Henry Clay Estate, like Farmington here in Louisville, have actually played a very important role in showcasing the importance of hemp as a modern product, and have really taken advantage of the public's interest in hemp to really draw visitors to sites like this one in Ashland, the Henry Clay Estate. So sites like Locust Grove, sites like Ashland, work with a group called United Hemp Industries to grow hemp test plots here. And how many of you all saw the hemp plot that was here a few years ago? That's awesome. Yeah, I was here for a meeting. We got to tour that, which was great. So what they've done is they've shown, A, the sustainability of the plant, but they've also worked to show how historic sites can help by showing what type of strains of hemp can thrive in modern Kentucky. So we know what modern strains can do great work here. They've also helped engage visitors here with important educational programming as part of that sort of attraction that people have to hemp as it becoming a legalized product here. I talked to Mary Beth Williams a few weeks ago about the things that they were doing. So the staff here worked with hemp advocates to plant a crop that met all the legal guidelines. As you can imagine, since it's a cousin to marijuana, there are a lot of hoops to jump through to grow it here. The site hemp had a hemp festival here for 2 years, correct? Where they had vendors, hemp food and products, and also educational programs. So again, this is a way that Locust Grove has tapped into a modern issue of importance to generate interest and show how our past is important today, which is great. Also, in talking to Mary Beth, I know they still have some hemp fibers here that they save that they can still use for educational programs in the future. So it's the gift that keeps on giving in terms of that product, to teach people about hemp. Well, a second example of how sites are using our state's past to engage modern audiences is South Union Shaker Village in Logan County, which is just south of Bowling Green, Kentucky. And this beautiful historic site, Shakers thrived there from about 1807 to 1922. And as part of our video series, I recently had the chance to sit down or to talk to Tommy Hines, who's the site director there. And I'm going to show you a quick 3-minute video about ways that they are working to highlight modern audiences. And let me mute this so I don't get too much feedback. I'm here with Tommy Hines, who's the executive director of South Union Shaker Village here in Logan County, Kentucky. And Tommy, thanks for having us.
Thank
today.
You.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about the site here?
This place was organized by the Shakers in 1807 as a result of the Great Revivals here in this part of the world. They came all the way from New York to establish 2 villages in Kentucky and 4 in Ohio and 1 in Indiana. South Union was the southernmost of all of those villages. And was very flourishing in the 19th century, both from an economic standpoint and a religious standpoint as well. So great success for them, but after the war began to decline because of lack of membership and problems with their economy, lack of workforce, and closed in 1922 as a result of that.
So how many buildings are on site here now that are open to the public?
There are 7 buildings that we have. 5 of those are open to the public on a daily basis. We're in the process of restoring that 6th building right now, which will hopefully be done in a couple of years.
Now, I know you guys are working on some new exhibits here. You've got a new building recently. I know there's an African American history exhibit that's going to open fairly soon. So what ways are you kind of working to connect with modern Americans to sort of teach them more about South Union Shaker Village?
We have found out that the Shakers had many of the same qualities and tenets that people really admire today. One of those being equality what we would consider tolerance today. The Shakers had African American and white members here that lived in the same rooms, side by side, worked together in the workshops. And even there are a lot of African Americans who rose to prominence within the village. For instance, we had an African American woman who was one of the trustees of the village, which meant she took care of the money. So they had opportunities here they would not have had in the world outside of the Shaker Village. We are going to be opening an exhibit in February during Black History Month that kind of chronicles a lot of the personal human stories of the African Americans who live there. Much of this material being exposed for the very first time in these wonderful manuscripts that still exist here.
So they're also sort of very green-minded and environmentally minded too. Have you found that's a way to connect with modern audiences as well?
I think that the modern audiences love the fact that the Shakers live simply. The Shakers did not waste anything. For instance, the water that they pumped into the kitchens to wash their dishes with went to the laundry next to be used and then went from there underground to the herb gardens to water those gardens. Things like that, the way that they use light in their buildings for good health. When somebody walks in this building, for instance, they cannot help but sort of be awed by these spaces, by the sound of your voice in these buildings, the light. So people are very, very impressed with what the Shakers did with so little resources compared to what we have today. But I think they're also interested, too, in those things like equality, intolerance, and the fact that the Shakers gave men and women equal rights here. In the 1820s and 30s, a man and a woman would oversee this place with equal power. That was not happening in the outside world in those days, and for many, many years to come, actually. There's just so many things that people are trying to do today in their homes, in their architecture, in their lives, really, that the Shakers were already doing 150 years ago.
Well, thank you so much for having us here today. I really encourage everyone to come visit South Union Shaker Village. It's a wonderful site that is really digging into some modern issues of relevance and importance. So, Tommy, thank you so much
for
having us.
Yes, sir.
Really appreciate it. Thanks.
If history is important to you, please like our videos, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and share with your family and friends.
Share with your family and friends. Oh, thanks. So just to recap that video a little bit, again, it's a great sight. We were there on a very dreary, I think it was a November, December day. It had been pouring rain, but it's a beautiful sight. How many of you all have been down there? South? Oh, wow, that's great. That's awesome. How many of you have been to the other Shaker Village, Pleasant Hill? Ah, you are my favorite people ever. I actually live fairly close. I live in Danville, fairly close to Pleasant Hill, so I'm there with the kids quite a bit. But just to sort of recap some of the things that Tommy said, and you all know that, you've been there, but they're really working hard to connect to these modern audiences. So again, at a time when slavery thrived across Kentucky, when over 20% of Kentucky's population were enslaved African Americans, you know, Shaker Village at South Union was really far ahead of its time, and that's one thing that they really focus on now. So they had tenets that people admire today: tolerance, equality. It was an integrated community during the 19th century, as Tommy mentioned. So you had African Americans and whites working together, living in the same spaces when Kentucky was racially segregated. Men and women had equal rights. Men and women both ran the community with equal authority. And then again, when he talked about the whole sustainability issue, and as we talk about coal and the decline of coal and, you know, renewable resources, you know, sustainability is an issue that comes up quite a bit. Shaker Village at South Union incorporates this into their programming and really work to connect that site to modern audiences and the things that modern audiences are really interested in. I think they're doing a wonderful job of not only connecting to the people, but really showcasing these issues that are of prominence and really matter. We also know how, in addition to historic sites like here at Locust Grove using hemp, Ashland using hemp, South Union talking about these sustainability and racial equality issues, we know that businesses across the Commonwealth are also using heritage and history to talk about why their products are important and why Kentucky is important. So, of course, we have, what's the first one? Distilleries across the state. You know, you can't go anywhere in Kentucky without seeing something related to the bourbon and the bourbon trail specifically. The Department of Tourism has recognized this in the state. Bourbon heritage and the history here is really important. And when you think about the distilleries in Louisville, across the Commonwealth, these distilleries are really using history and heritage as a way to draw in visitors. If you've done a distillery tour, what are they highlighting? They're highlighting, you know, the authentic. That's what visitors want. They want those authentic experiences. Moreover, they connect these brands with people from their history. So think about E.H. Taylor. That's a brand of bourbon. Jim Beam, of course, you know, was a real distiller. I actually lived next door to his great-granddaughter, which is kind of funny. She doesn't give me free bourbon, unfortunately, but that's another gripe for another time. Elijah Craig, you know, you have all these brands that are named after historic distillers. The Henry McKenna brand, which Heaven Hill owns, actually won the 2018 Best Bourbon Award at the 2018 San Francisco World Spirits Competition. And so McKenna was actually, had come to the Bardstown area from Ireland, lived in Lexington for a while, but ended up settling in Nelson County. He ended up building roads, was sort of a contract road worker, saved up his money, bought a small distillery, then it expanded and expanded. By the 1920s, the McKenna brand was huge in Nelson County. Heaven Hill eventually purchased it. McKenna, again, he was a fairly poor immigrant into Kentucky. He always lived very simply, never spent any of his money. And one day he went back to Ireland on a trip with his wife to sort of visit the old home place. And while he was gone, it was an extensive, extended trip, his children actually built him a giant brick mansion of like 15, 18 rooms or something. So he comes home, they hand him the keys, and he was like, he ended up living in a small house for another year or two until they could convince him to move into the grandiose house. So he lived simply, but now, you know, the legacy of that is still promoted today. And again, the Henry McKenna brand won at the World Spirits Competition. Another business, another Kentucky born and bred business, is Ale 81. How many of you heard of Ale 81? Ah, Ale 8, yeah. We actually toured that distillery fairly recently, which is a lot of fun. We have another video that'll come out on that. But Ale 81 is celebrating its 116th year in Kentucky now. If you don't know about the name, it's Ale number 81. And back when that was created, the creator of Ale 81 had actually been sued by Coca-Cola because he had a specific cola. He ended up winning that lawsuit, but he realized, look, I've got to diversify. And he'd been to England before. He loved ginger beer. So he decided to make sort of a ginger soft drink, which eventually became Ale 81. So he opened up a competition to pick the name, and a young woman in the community suggested a late one. And at the time, a late one meant something that was trendy, something that was cool, something that was popular. So he sort of finagled it, and it eventually became AL81. So that's the history of the company. We had a great time talking to the president and the CEO there. And they really used history to think about not only the past of the company, but also where they're going as a future company. When we interviewed the president, we realized on their wall was their vision statement. And part of that vision statement said, our history is inspiration for the future. So coming from the Kentucky Historical Society, we were extremely excited to see that a business in the state with such a great legacy had that as part of their vision and mission statement. Again, our history is inspiration for the future. The company's still family owned. It's the fourth generation now owning it and running it. The president is still the only one who knows the secret formula and mixes up the secret formula of AL81. So you know, they've got that great sort of corporate family secret tied into it as well. But as a private company, they're not thinking about the next shareholders meeting. They're thinking about how are they going to hand the business over to the next generation of family members. And so in doing that, they continually look to the past. And it was a great conversation we had with them. And the president said that the founder's name is G.L. Wainscott. And she said to us, she goes, look, everything here has to be Wainscott worthy. That's what we think about. We think about the founder of this company, what he would have wanted to do, because we're the caretakers for that next generation. It was just wonderful to talk about them and the legacy of their company. Another Kentucky-based company that is using history as a way to promote their product is Alltech. And this is as you all know, it's an animal feed. It's an international animal feed company. They also own several distilleries, including a new one that they opened in Pikeville called Dueling Barrels. And as part of that, I'm going to show you another quick video about how Alltech is using history and sort of the heritage of Eastern Kentucky to promote this new product.
I'm here with Lauren Dozier, who's from Alltech, which is an international biotechnology company based in Kentucky. And Lauren, what brings you to the Kentucky Historical Society today?
Alltech is on its latest venture in brewing and distilling. We're opening a new facility in Pikeville, Kentucky. And what we're looking for today are different ways to show the sights and sounds of the history that surrounds that region. One of the things that's very important to us in this project is to really show off the history surrounding the region, surrounding, you know, distilling and moonshine and immigration, the stories of dance and culture and song that really shape the whole region. And it's important for us to do that accurately and consistently. And so with the Kentucky Historical Society, we're really looking for a partnership and someone to help us tell those stories in a way that maybe we can't do on our own. So we've come here today to kind of give our entire creative team a look at exactly what might be available to us to use that way.
So the distillery in Pikeville is called Dueling Barrels,
yes.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
And how did you all use history to sort of inform the idea behind that distillery?
From a historical standpoint, the name Dueling Barrels is certainly a nod to the Hatfield and McCoy feud. We want to tell, from a historical approach, how we got to where we are today, sort of telling that story through the lens of whiskey and moonshine and distilling. We wanted to share that story with visitors. When they come into Dueling Barrels, we want to show them, you know, obviously the whiskey and the bourbon and you know, we want to show those things too. But really, we want to tell the story that unfolds in those mountains. That really was important to our founders, Dr. and Mrs. Lyons, who wanted to share those stories because the Eastern Kentucky region is important to them. They're from Ireland and immigrated to Kentucky. And so it was important to them to share the stories that really can be traced back through immigration to Ireland. So we wanted to be sure that was a part of the Dueling Barrels experience.
Does Alltech also want to use that sort of authentic history as a way to market the distillery once it's open?
We want to give visitors a really authentic experience so that when they come to Dueling Barrels, they can get really a taste, literally and figuratively, of the history and culture of the region.
So how do you think it's important to use authentic collections, whether it's
archival collections or a museum piece to really help tell that story at the distillery.
We wanted to take a local approach, and that was one of the reasons we reached out to the Kentucky Historical Society in the first place. We want to give them a hands-on, interactive experience that really takes them back through the sights and sounds.
When does Dueling Barrels open in Pikeville? Do you all know when it's going to open?
Spring of 2018.
Exciting!
We're very excited.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you
really
for having me.
Thank you.
If history is important to you, please like our videos, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and share with your family and friends.
Share with your family and friends. There we go again. So again, All Tech came to the Kentucky Historical Society. The Dueling Barrels is actually now open in Pikeville. So I'd encourage you guys to go down there and do a tour. But, they came to us to sort of get a sense of how can they interpret this history to people, because they wanted to use history as a means to use history and heritage as a way to market that product. I'm glad you got to see a little bit about our collection space, little sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark, if you remember that movie. It's like one of my friends, a curator at KHS, says, we're essentially Kentucky's attic, which is true. And there was a picture of Devil Ants Hatfield's rifle. And one time we were doing a behind-the-scenes tour, and I had on the blue plastic gloves, and this curator, he handed me a rifle. He's like, here, just hold this. And he was pulling out John Hunt Morgan's, saddle brush or something like that. I hand it back to him. He goes, you like that? I said, yeah. He goes, well, that's Devil Ants Hatfield's rifle. And here, it's just, anyway, just a very amazing experience. That's, again, it goes back to Daniel Boone's quote I used earlier. These are the objects that sort of really engage us and make us curious and interested in things. And that's why All Tech came to us, and they went to other museums in the region to really get a sense of that history and heritage as they market that new product and tie it to the regions. I recently interviewed David Akison, who's president of the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce as well, and that we had an event, and he was there, and he recognized the importance of history and also historical context. He said, issues that we're facing today in Kentucky are very similar to the ones we've faced before. Therefore, as he said, of course we need to look back to the past in order to inform our present. And so we know that museums like Locust Grove and The Hemp, we know that businesses like All Tech and AL81 are really looking backward in order to apply history to ensure that their sites, their museums, and their companies and businesses are moving forward in the future. Now, I want to close today with a quick call to action. And what that is, I've talked about the importance of museums, how they're economic drivers, but we all know Kentucky's economy, budgets are very tight across the nonprofit sector, and there's not a lot of money for museums anymore. But there is one program called the Kentucky Local History Trust Fund that I would encourage you guys to support. And on your state income taxes, you have the checkoff boxes, you can help Fish and Wildlife, you can help other causes, but there's one called the Kentucky Local History Trust Fund. And the donations that are made to that, when you check that box, donate part of your tax return to that fund, all that money comes to the Kentucky Historical Society. We then pool it all together, and then we re-grant it out to museums across the Commonwealth. And so the grants that we give out every year as part of that fund go to help sustainability issues. So we're looking to help museums across the long term, whether it's helping them with educational programs, sustainability issue, disaster planning, which is, of course, very important. You all see the news about that museum in Brazil that burned down. Horrible, horrible. So it shows how important disaster prep is, and these grants help. So next time you're doing your taxes, think about that poor museum in Brazil where we've lost treasures of worldwide importance, and know that if you make that mark for history, you're doing a great job in helping potentially protect collections in the future, including here at Locust Grove. I'm not sure if you guys have applied for one of those grants yet, but I would encourage you guys to do so in the future, because so far we've given out well over, we've had the program for 2 years, we've given out, I think it's over $40,000 at this point, and we'll be announcing a new round of grants fairly soon. We've helped well over 30 organizations across the state. But thank you so much for having me here today. I hope I've at least explained a little bit why museums are important to the state and how a lot of these public and private entities are using history as a way to help their causes and help their businesses. So thank you all very much. And all the videos are available on our YouTube channel, and so I do encourage you to share with your family and friends, and please subscribe if you can. But any questions at all? Yes, sir?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so the statement was, I didn't mention historic sites specifically, even though I would include museums as historic sites usually, but historic preservation as well being so important. And, you know, that is an important economic driver as well. My background is actually in historic preservation. I worked for the Perryville Battlefield Preservation Association for about 10 years, so I know the economic benefits of heritage preservation, and also how historic sites like Perryville can be basically learning laboratories of study. You know, you may not be inside a building like this, you may be outside walking a battlefield, but by walking in the literal footsteps of history, by going to those authentic places where history actually happened, I think you can learn a lot more. So, you know, you can go down to the Mill Springs battlefield, learn about leadership, and find out where did the Confederate generals really fail there. You know, so there are these great ways that our battlefields and our historic sites can not only help educate Kentuckians, but can also be important economic drivers as well. Because a big part of that heritage tourism are our battlefields. The Kentucky Civil War Sites Association just finished up a blue ribbon study about the economic impact of battlefields across the state. And that includes everything from Perryville, its Civil War site, so Camp Nelson in Jessamine County, which is an incredible site that may potentially become a national park soon. It was one of the nation's largest recruiting grounds for African-American soldiers during the Civil War, which we know that, you know, a really harrowing journey for these slaves who made the trip to Camp Nelson. One slave who escaped and made it this way to Camp Nelson, he said, "Camp Nelson is our Canada," meaning that if we can get to Camp Nelson, we can find freedom. And we know that thousands of African-Americans from Kentucky enlisted there. And so, you know, these places are extremely important because they can also talk about ways that past is important today. So I agree with you. Part of it is I only have 40 minutes, so I can't talk about it. Yes, ma'am. Right.
You know, they were ignorant and, you know, so forth and so on. And his theory was that as the country, as people were going westward and were crossing the Appalachians, that only it was the survival of the fittest, and the weakest of the people couldn't get across the mountains, and they settled, of course, in eastern Kentucky, in Appalachia. And his theory was it's because they were the weakest and not, you know, survival of the fittest, and that's why they were, quote,
right.
Is there
any the question was, she had a professor in college when she was in college just 10 years ago that said that hillbilly culture and Kentuckians being seen as sort of ignorant and backwards from that portion of the state, that it came about as a result of survival of the fittest because they were actually weaker and couldn't make it past the mountains, and asked, what did I think about that? I would disagree vehemently about that. Especially, I've got family roots in Bell County, Kentucky, in eastern Kentucky, in Pineville, and I know that side of the family was certainly probably equally hardy as my Todd family descendants in the bluegrass of Kentucky. But no, I think, you know, their economic, I mean, there he's been so exploited over time. I'm working on a book now. It's about a duel that was fought in Kentucky during the Civil War between a Union colonel and a pro-Confederate civilian. And as part of that, I'm looking at how did violence evolve in Kentucky after the Civil War. And so after the Civil War, kind of the formal violence of the duel among upper-class Kentuckians was replaced by spontaneous violence. The sort of code of honor still existed in Kentucky after the Civil War, but they didn't adhere to that formal process of the duel that was supposed to keep violence dispassionate. So essentially, the Civil War kind of deregulated violence in Kentucky. You had upper-class Kentuckians who were carrying pistols constantly, and if one was insulted from about 1870 until 1920, instead of challenging someone to a formal duel, they would instead pull out their pistol and just shoot you. So it became Kentucky became noted for its violence. This appeared in newspaper articles across the state, and so what really happened was, whereas we were once the erudite land of compromise and Henry Clay, those post-war years from regulator violence or Klan violence to shootings among upper-class Kentuckians really sent Kentucky's reputation on a downward spiral. So I would contend that a lot of those arguments about the hillbilly culture being dumb people actually has more to do with media coverage in the 1920s and the extraction of the area's resources at the expense of the local people more than it does in anything like that. So that's a long way of saying I would disagree with that theory. I think it's a lot more complicated than that. It has a lot more to do with sort of the reputation of Kentucky having the sort of consistent decline after the Civil War years to, again, the extraction of coal and other resources that locals really didn't have a chance to benefit from, whereas these sort of larger corporations in the Northeast, you know, that's why they built railroads there, was to extract the timber, extract the coal, and then spend the money elsewhere. So that's probably too long of an answer for that, but you know, I'll come back and talk about the duel if you ever want. That'd be fun. So, yes, ma'am.
What about the health industry and the invention of the mechanical heart? Where is there a museum that talks about?
Yeah, is there a health museum? Yeah. So the question was, you know, the mechanical heart was invented in Kentucky. Is there a museum that sort of talks about that? I don't think there's one that really talks about modern museum, or modern health issues specifically. But there are historic museums that talk about modern health issues. Like I think. I live in Danville. I'm a couple blocks away from the Ephraim McDowell House in Danville, where in 1809, Ephraim McDowell removed a 22-pound ovarian cyst from his patient, Jane Todd Crawford. It was at that time, 1809, physicians believed that if you opened up the abdominal cavity, it would cause death to the patient. So really, McDowell sort of did this. He'd studied in Scotland. They didn't know about germ theory, but the Scottish, the Scottish Enlightenment had been going on. So physicians in Scotland understood there was some connection to being clean, washing your hand, and survival of the patients. So on Christmas Day, 1809, Jane Todd Crawford, who thought she was pregnant with twins, again, they figured out she had this massive ovarian tumor. McDowell removed it and then became known as the father of modern surgery. So the McDowell House is still a thriving house museum. It's in Danville, Kentucky. It's in Danville, in Boyle County. And so they do talk about modern medical issues there. So there are none that really talk about those sort of modern issues. In addition, there are other historic sites, like my old Kentucky home, for example, that there was there were several cholera epidemics in Kentucky in the 1830s, 1840s, and 1850s. At my old Kentucky home, they talk about a cholera epidemic that not only wiped out several members of the Rowan family who lived there, but also a number of their enslaved African Americans, too. So, you know, disease becomes the great equalizer when you look at history. It doesn't matter. If you owned Stately Federal Hill, you know, the building known as my old Kentucky home, or if you were living in the slave cabin in the back, you know, those diseases were, again, the great equalizer. So there are sites that, you know, may not be talking about modern inventions yet, but they are talking about sort of historic medicine as it pertains to Kentucky. My first book was about the aftermath of the Battle of Perryville and sort of how communities contended with these thousands and thousands of casualties, but also thousands of sick people. In Danville alone, Danville had a population of about 3,500 inhabitants in 1862, and after the Battle of Perryville, there were more than 3,000 sick Union soldiers who were ill from dysentery, typhoid, pneumonia, and all these illnesses were left in Danville, basically doubling the population of the town. So that'd be the equivalent of today. There are about 15,000 people in Danville. It'd be the equivalent of 15,000 sick people being left in Danville. So every, you know, the courthouse, private homes, every church, every public place became, you know, a massive hospital to deal with these patients. There's also a drought going on at the time, so like they had to haul in water from miles away. One surgeon who had spent days performing operations essentially said he couldn't find enough water to wash the blood from his hands for 2 days. So, you know, there are sites that talk about this fairly grisly. Sorry, I tend to go off on these tangents, but you know, there are sites that are looking into sort of medicine and things like that. Sorry, I'm rambling, but that's, yes, ma'am. Yeah, if you go online, you can find places. We actually probably need to put one on our site, but if you just Google up Kentucky museums, you can find quite a few. There are a few out there that sort of have a fairly comprehensive list. Even Wikipedia, I think, has a collection of the sites, museums, things like that. But any more questions at all? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, you've got an interest. Yeah, and so she was talking about IT history and more about sort of technology that has been spawned in Kentucky, and that's neat. Yeah, and I think, you know, museums are also sort of, I think, more intentionally thinking about how we can connect to modern audiences in that way. Because, like, you know, it used to be if you go to a house museum, it was, here are the curtains. You know, this is the bathtub that Cassius Marcellus Clay sat in after he was minister to Russia, and this is the carpet. And it was sort of, you know, that kind of you know, cushioned chairs, and, you know, they didn't get into those modern issues as much. And I think Kentucky's historic sites are really doing a great job you know, like Locust Grove, looking at hemp, looking at other issues. I mean, you know, they've got a distillery here now, which, you know, taking advantage of that interest in bourbon to learn how Kentuckians like George Rogers Clark, you know, how did they make money at the time? I mean, you know, that's another important issue. You know, what was the economy of Kentucky at the time? So I think, you know, there are a million ways that these museums and sites can go, and I think places like Locust Grove, places like Perryville, places like Ephraim McDowell House are really doing a good job to tap into ways that are important to modern Americans. It can also use that history to sort of teach us more about where we're going for the future. But thank you all for having me. I really appreciate it. Thanks.